What would happen if instead of composing predetermined assignments, college composition students could compose whatever they want to compose? What would happen if students could set their own deadlines and grade their own work? Find out as Assistant Professor Mason Joyner and I explore these questions with a few of our fellow English department colleagues. I'm Monica Mankin, and this is the English 101 Experiment. Welcome to the English 101 Experiment podcast. This is season 2, episode 1. I am Monica Mankin. I'm a full professor of English here at Delgado Community College in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Mason Joyner. I am an assistant professor here at Delgado Community College in New Orleans, Louisiana. And we have our guest today.
Yeah, Ari Zeiger, also an English professor here at Delgado.
Awesome.
Yeah, and welcome back, Ari. You joined us for an episode during season 1, so we're happy to have you back. So this will be a little bit more text-based throughout the season. We're planning to bring in texts that we like to share with our students, and also texts that address the scholarship in support of, or maybe not in support of, and we're going to kind of respond to that. Mm-hmm. The pedagogy, the practices that drive the English 101 experiment. We have two texts today. One is a poem, and it's called, we've had a lot of discussion about Daedal, but we're, again, kind of still with our myth of Icarus and Daedalus. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this poem is called Daedal by A.E. Stallings. To build a labyrinth, it takes a twisted mind, a puzzled art, a fractal branching of mistakes. Drag out the shovels and the rakes, the spirit level, sacred chart. To build a labyrinth, it takes shadows, stones, a way that snakes, and ladders to its shaky start. An average mazing of mistakes, the kind that everybody makes. Set random intervals apart. To build a labyrinth, it takes dead ends that seem like lucky breaks, the path of bats that weave and dart through limestone caverns of mistakes. The shaken etch-a-sketch awakes, a lost child buried in its heart. To build a labyrinth, it takes some good intentions, some mistakes.
We have a work of scholarship here for you today. It is titled Daedalus and Icarus Within, The Literature-Art-Writing Connection by Gabrielle Lusser Rico.
So, Mason, you're the one that discovered
That's right.
this text. Do you have like a, you know, maybe a one or two sentence summary?
I think so. So Rico in this text, and this was published, by the way, yeah, for the reader. This was published in 1989 in the English Journal. And Rico in this text is sort of talking about a, you know, pedagogical strategy centered around a couple of steps with her students. And by the way, she's teaching like arts and humanities type classes. That first step is establishing dominant metaphors for students to make connections to with every work that they encounter, using the practice of cluster mapping to, you know, flesh out their ideas and the connections they're making around those dominant metaphors, and eventually turning those cluster-mapped ideas into, I think, what Rico calls thought logs.
Great term.
Yeah, where the student is simply giving composition to their thoughts, right? I'll begin by sharing an excerpt that really stood out to me. As Monica said, it was sort of continuing on our metaphor tied to the Daedalus and Icarus myth. And Rico puts it in a way I find really interesting here. Just as the Daedalus story embodies the universal human impulse toward making art, the related story of the sun, Icarus, embodies the universal adolescent impulse toward freedom.
Nice. Ari, do you have an excerpt from
this? I do. On page 16 and the top of the second column, where the author writes this. Every new idea to be learned requires rediscovery by the learner, or, as Piaget observed, quote, for anyone truly to learn something for himself, he must recreate it for himself.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Monica, what about you?
Yeah, so I actually also had both of those highlighted, so that's great. I'm excited for our discussion. I'm going to go with the last on page 23 of the text, so the very last page, where Rico's concluding, ultimately, cultural literacy is useless unless students are given the opportunity to create meaningful contexts for themselves, for each other, for the subject matter. In sum, for richer learning experiences, which they help to create. We might well remember that the Latin, educare, still means to draw out, never to pound in. And the arts are an inexhaustible source to effect that drawing out.
So we have source material, like the poem we read at the top, mm-hmm. right? And that's a piece that you brought in to your students.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's like a classroom artifact, mm-hmm. right? And then mm-hmm. we have the scholarship that is informing different choices that you're making, mm-hmm. right? And so I think take it where you will. Would you want to talk about like how you're using, I guess probably let's stick with the scholarship, right? How is this informing?
Yeah.
How is this informing your pedagogy? Yeah.
Right. So what's kind of funny about this is that Mason discovered this while searching for good academic writing, and just kind of sent it to me. I think maybe because of the title. I don't even know that you had really read it when you first sent it to me.
I tore it open like a Christmas present because of the title, yes, okay. And then sent it to you.
Okay, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, so of course I was like, oh, Daedalus and Icarus, mm-hmm. like I've got to read this. And so in reading it, I was really, I don't know, encouraged maybe is the right word there, to encounter another instructor who had discovered that allowing students to be the meaning makers is perhaps more effective than some of the other models of quote-unquote education. And I think that's where the excerpt that I shared really, I think, captures it. It's a good conclusion to this article that it's a drawing out, not a pounding in.
Yeah.
And that also, Rico students create their own projects.
Right.
So there's already that collaborative assessment going on in a different course that's not a writing course, humanities.
Mm-hmm. The Piaget quote that you read, I had that highlighted as well. I think Mark,
yes,
you said
I did too.
We all highlighted that.
Yeah. And it's mentioned twice in the article.
Yeah. The idea of learning something by recreation, I think, is something that we were already experimenting with. There's that imitation, for example, as a as an instructional tool. And so, yeah, I think this article felt gratifying in a lot of ways to see, as Monica said, things that we've been playing with. You know, Rico was doing in 1989,
mm-hmm. yeah,
and that just it feels good, I guess, to read how this went.
And to also, I guess, encounter this metaphor that I think for both of us has mm-hmm. started to develop into something beyond just, you know, last year when we were reading Failing and Flying, mm-hmm. Jack Gilbert's poem, which kind of offers us a different perspective of Icarus, mm-hmm. right, in the myth. I feel like we're sort of fleshing that out as a greater metaphor within our course. too. So yeah. I felt like there was a nice connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this article, it's not, I would not categorize this article as a kind of, I don't know, this is where I'm like a mission statement for a type of teaching, although it is, but it does it through sharing classroom practices.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is like grounded in classroom practices. And so I imagine that you guys were, y'all were like looking at this and thinking how this can apply or what this sparks for you, how, what you want to try. And
tomorrow or Friday rather, in a couple of days, I'm trying out this cluster mapping method in class for the first time to see specifically the method that Rico is talking about here. And so I'm excited. It's also the idea of sort of formalizing the dominant metaphors of a course, I think is a fun thing to chew on. Something I want to explore more moving forward.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
I haven't really quite fleshed it out because I'm with Mason, where I feel like it's emerging, but it hasn't revealed itself, you know, yet.
Right.
And I think maybe by the end of the semester, or the end of this academic year, I'll have more to say on that specifically.
It's almost as if we're in a labyrinth of mistakes.
Oh, and we can't quite see the way out.
Yes.
Yeah. but as far as trying things, I really liked the exercise, and this is on page 18, the Icarus story in painting and poetry, and having the students look at Bruegel's The Fall of Icarus, and without giving them the title of the painting, have them examine the painting and come up with their own titles for it.
Yeah.
It just, in so many ways, what an exercise that is, because as Rico points out, students don't even really notice Icarus.
I had a student say, "No, he's not drowning; he's swimming." And because, you know, without the title, you don't. It's not immediately apparent.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried them naming the painting as well, and it was a really fun experience to see what they came up with.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how it fits in and is relevant quite yet to other things that we do, but I like it as just kind of an exercise. But I did make a note, toward what? An exercise toward what? I don't know.
So sort of high level, you know, what we are as readers, what we are meant to understand, and it's also is said explicitly in this scholarship directly, is the idea of the student as agentic, the student as you were saying, meaning maker, the student as the sort of the place where the learning is created. But that we can't leave it there, because then that's just like almost like the bromides of liberation. Like, how does it happen? How does it happen? And that is what I so appreciate in this scholarship, is this is what it looks like in my classroom when I'm teaching towards that North Star.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe, like, I don't know if this connects with what you're kind of getting at, Ari, but I think at the top of that section on the Icarus story in painting and poetry, where Rico writes, "Just as the Daedalus story embodies the universal human impulse toward making art, the related story of the son, Icarus, embodies the universal adolescent impulse toward freedom." And it's kind of like that is where we're grappling, I think, still with our experiment, is that there is this impulse toward making art, but also toward what meaning we make through academic work, through academic writing, while also balancing that with choice, with freedom.
Beautiful quote you pulled. I have that highlighted as well. And I remember just really appreciating that sentence, especially the word choice, embodies the universal adolescent impulse toward freedom. Like, the word universal is doing so much. It takes any of the judgment away from, you know, that maybe adolescent brings in the judgment. Universal takes it out. I think this is so much of what educators, teachers dream of, which is to be able to use the scholarship of the past to inform like what they're doing in their classroom in a very like practical way, right? And it's sort of what, because it's sort of like when we were in grad school, we're taught, we're taught to like, hey, read this and think about any classroom applications.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. That's on the assignment sheet.
Yeah.
But we've been out of grad school for many decades.
Yeah, longer than I care to say.
And yet we're coming back to that noble practice. Mm-hmm. And talk about that.
I think it feels sacred in a way. Mm-hmm. Like you know, uncovering this text by Rico is like, oh wow, this is somebody who is doing really good work. Gosh, how long ago was that? And I don't know, yeah, it's just something, there's something really, to your point, like we're not compelled to do this normally, unless we've got, I don't know, this is a reminder, I guess is what I'm trying to say, of the value in reading and documenting what you've done for future teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think maybe to speak to that sacred comment of like this, mm-hmm. that it's sort of affirming that we're part of a tradition,
yeah.
and that there are, it's just like with writing itself, right? And particularly, like, I'm going to talk about poetry. There are different, I guess, facets of poetic tradition that you like find yourself drawn to, and that you might carry on in your own practice. And I think that it's kind of nice to see that goes for teaching too. Mm-hmm. There's already this conversation and this tradition like rolling forward and mm-hmm. we're just a part of something already in motion.
And it's just staying current with quotes around it because 1989, mm-hmm. but staying current with scholarship, mm-hmm. right? Is it's so ennobling to one's own sense of self-determination, mm-hmm. right? Like, we're just not accepting the status quo, not just doing the same thing year after year. I mean, these are some of the things that we've already, like, discussed and sort of know about ourselves, but it's just a perfect example. I think maybe one thing I would like to touch on personally is just to linger a little longer on what I really feel is so powerful about this piece, which is that it really does spell out the three components, mm-hmm. right, that make up this approach. So it's on page mm-hmm. 16, mm-hmm. and it would be the end of the first paragraph. Both courses make use of three strategies. One, dominant metaphors to focus student attention. Two, clustering around the metaphors, as well as specific works of art and literature to discover mm-hmm. their individual responses. And three, the writing of vignettes, entries in thought logs to articulate their responses. Okay. And I don't know, any one of those three, do we want to, just kind of go say a little bit more on?
Perhaps the writing of vignettes or entries in thought logs. Journaling at some point was a core part of the English 101 experiment.
Well, for me, it's still very much a part of the course. Mm-hmm. And we're going to keep calling it journal. I'm not sold on thought logs you guys are.
Yeah, I was thinking today, just actually before mm-hmm. we came to the studio, if you write like a half a page essay, you know, like what is that really called? Essay, it may not be the best term. Mm-hmm. And so the word thought log came to mind having just read this. Vignette is an interesting word, even though we would probably need some explanation. Mm-hmm.
Vignette's a great word.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. It presupposes length.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thought logs, the journals, the vignettes, mm-hmm. but there is some sort of response, right, that then would be mm-hmm. kind of where the writing, mm-hmm. right, is captured. But there's so much here that is so novel and new and inspiring to us, but there's also somewhat here that is familiar to us, mm-hmm. right? And just when you were talking about the clustering, right? On some level, many teachers might, and I think falsely think that's just a thing that we do when we're brainstorming.
Right.
Right.
That was an assumption I functioned under.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, there's a chapter in a English 101 book, and it's like types of brainstorming, right?
Yeah.
Outlining.
I remember the chapter.
Clustering. So I don't know. Yeah, just if there's anything else, maybe we want to touch on it in terms of those three classroom practices, we can. Do we feel like we've done justice to the idea of the dominant metaphors to focus student attention?
Well, maybe that can come back to the poem.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. Mm. The quote that has been shared a couple of times, you know, Icarus represents the universal adolescent, you know, urge for freedom, whereas Daedalus represents the universal urge for creativity. And I like bringing Daedalus into the conversation, right? Whereas for the past couple of years, it's just been Icarus for mm-hmm. us, right? And I like that we're bringing Daedalus into the conversation mm-hmm. too, and what he metaphorically represents to us and to students, I think, mm-hmm. as a creator of labyrinths, of complex, complicated things that we're not sure how to make.
Mm-hmm. I maybe want to go back before we dive into the poem itself. To another passage, a short passage on page 16 of Rico's piece, the artistic impulse, the roots of the artistic impulse in its UUR, which is uneasiness, uncertainty, and restlessness. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of directly connect this idea and what Daedalus mm-hmm. represents in terms of artistic impulse in this poem, A.E. Stallings' poem, right, where, because we are uneasy with mistakes, and but they're almost necessary. It's like, in order to create, mm-hmm. you have to allow yourself to be uneasy, uncertain. There is probably a restlessness at work in you, and you're trying to, like, get something out of your mind onto a canvas or a piece of paper or however you're, you know.
Yeah. That uncertainty can be so paralyzing sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I think for students to see that uncertainty, I know it makes you want to not do anything, but it's at that point that we start walking.
A major point, if we think about it from the point of view of the students, right? Especially in an English class, right? Because English class, there's so much about the idea of, you know, is this good?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Whereas I think in a lot of other classes, not all, but the question is this right?
Well, and I'm glad you say that, because I think part of what I noticed that I've been doing is really trying to retrain students' vocabulary around writing so that mm-hmm. they aren't asking, am I doing this correctly? Mm-hmm. That's not the purpose of the exercise here. Yeah. We're not focusing on correctness so much as we're focusing on, to use your word from when we're talking to students about workshopping, mm-hmm. enhancements. How do we enhance this? How do we take it to the next level? I found myself saying that a lot today.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, how do we? So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's a beautiful thing. Like today in my class, we were writing about a text, and because one of my core beliefs is that the teacher as writer, okay, mm-hmm. and so I'm writing about the text as well. The students can see my screen, and my writing that they were seeing in my writing about the text was so, like, sort of wonderfully mediocre, you know? And then I paused and I went meta, right? And I said to the class, so class, what you're seeing me doing right here with this kind of first draft language, with this kind of very middle of the road, I don't know, like kind of like medium quality language, mm-hmm. I'm okay with that because I will return to this and I will edit towards amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never said that phrase before, but that's what I said. I will edit towards amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because I know that I'll do that, I don't need to write amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then one of my students raised their hand and I was, and they were like, okay, so like you're saying that like if you can just delay the need to be amazing till the editing, well, then you can, there's a willingness to just, to try.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, there's just a willingness to try.
Yes.
And so then I said, yes, because if we need to write amazing as opposed to edit, you know, to amazing, mm-hmm. well, like, we're going to try based on our mood. Yeah. Like, we're just going to try to write, like, whether or not we're, like, willing to, like, I don't know. I just said, like, it's just sort of based on our mood, whether or not we're going to be able to, like, be amazing that day as, like, our first draft.
Yeah.
That's, trust me, that's mood independent, I said.
Yeah. And actually, that reminds me of a podcast I've had students listen to called The Science of Procrastination. And it does talk, that procrastination is related to the exact mood-based approach to whatever you're doing. Mm. So that's interesting. But I think I love that you brought up writing in front of your students, which I know we touched upon that in last season. And I was actually just doing that today because we're working on project one where students have selected from the different texts that we've read so far. This poem is actually one of them.
Love it.
But they're working on imitations, right? And I'm doing this with them. I chose The Ugly Tourist. Jamaica Kincaid's The Ugly Tourist. And I definitely am I'm hitting some dead ends, and like I am running up against the walls in the labyrinth that is writing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I can see them watching too, and then they're like, oh yeah, like she doesn't know what to say there. She just put three X's and didn't finish that thought, and now she's like writing a whole nother pair. Like, they can see that this is like the process, right? I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like showing them when I just look up synonyms for a word.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to use this word, but I can't just like pull the one I want out of thin air. I have to look at the options.
Mm-hmm. And then taste comes, and then taste. Yeah, will determine. And you using that placeholder technique of dot, 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 or XXX, right? Again, what a go-to part of a writer's process that is so hard to actually put onto a piece of, onto like a poster, right? And hang in the wall and say, this is the writing process.
Yes.
But it's so real and hard won and niche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I love that.
So, Monica, how did you bring Deedle into your classroom?
I know we're already in week six, and I think this was part of week one.
I think it was,
I brought both this poem and Failing and Flying in on the same day. I read it aloud, but then I had students like reread it together in small groups and then talk about what's it talking about? Do you know the myth? Do you understand what Deedle is? Because like a lot of them, it was really funny. Like they're annotating, but nobody was like making a note about the title. So I noticed that and I said, so what is Deedle? And they look at me, you know, blankly. And I was like, well, how come you didn't look it up? How come you didn't annotate it? At least with like a question mark, you know? So we started there and I found this online 8-minute recording of the myth, just the telling of the story of these two mythological characters. We didn't listen to it in class. I told them that this is something you can do on your own if you're interested, because in some ways I think this poem can stand on its own even if you don't get that reference. Mm-hmm. But you'll want to get that reference so that the poem's meaning can deepen and expand for you. Yeah. And so we read this. We tried to kind of, break it down. They had some students really liked it. I had a student who sort of said that the poem itself is like a labyrinth. Mm. It feels very labyrinth-like. Nice. So like the form is, form and function are married there. But then we turned over our handout, and on the other side was Failing and Flying. And so we read that, and we talked more about the mythology, and also just how these two poets borrowed the mythology in very mm-hmm. different ways to write two completely different style poems.
Cool. Yeah.
Which is something I feel like I'm coming back to later in this in the term. But yeah, so Mason, what? How did it go for you? Because I think you brought
it
in.
It was just last week.
Yeah,
me.
Okay.
Yeah, week five. Yeah, so for me, this was paired with Anne Lamott's Shitty First Drafts.
Mm.
The idea of to build a labyrinth that takes mistakes, right? And I think that's in so many words Anne Lamott's point as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also. I had them, you know, reflect back, like you, we did Failing and Flying back week one, and so I had them try and connect it back to that, and similar experience of them not realizing who Deedle was until, you know, we said it out loud, and they're like, oh, and, you know, this is this big unlocking moment. Of,
right.
I saw them, I'm in a computer lab, I saw them looking up a labyrinth so they could just like
yes.
see what a labyrinth is mm-hmm. Without my prompting them to do that. That was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Something that stood out to me is that that the two lines of the poem that they wanted to talk about more than any others is the first two lines of the last stanza.
Yes.
The shaken Etch-a-Sketch awakes a lost child buried in its heart.
Yeah, we spent time on that too.
They really loved those two lines.
What did they, what was the meaning they gleaned from them?
So one student said it reminded her of how there's always still a child inside of you, mm-hmm. like even as you grow up, there's a lost child deep in there. I think they also just really connected to, and I think that's one of the qualities of this line is the nostalgia of the Etch-a-Sketch mm-hmm. connects to that lost child as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them, I could hear, oh, do you remember what Etch-a-Sketch is? It's that thing where you get the two knobs and then you shake.
Yeah,
like
some of them
like
looked
reminding
that up
each
too,
other
yeah.
so I'm of what an Etch-a-Sketch was.
Yeah.
What did your students make of those lines?
The word that was kind of throwing a wrench in things was the shaken
mm-hmm.
Etch-a-Sketch. So it's the erasing
yeah.
of whatever had been made that awakes a lost child.
Right.
And then I think, too, after some of them did visit the myth,
mm-hmm.
There was a connection to perhaps the lost child is
yeah.
Icarus. And there's a much bigger mistake mm-hmm. that's kind of underlying, you know,
yeah.
the whole poem. So it was... I don't yeah. know that we reached any sort of conclusion of meaning, but it's something that's why I think I want to kind of keep revisiting mm-hmm. and kind of adding more and more to our knowledge yeah. of the myth, but also the ways in which this has been interpreted yeah. and repurposed through. There's so many different poems out there, and actually Rico includes a lot of them
yes.
in
yes, she does.
This article. To just keep exploring mm-hmm. that and how
yeah.
that helps us to keep adding layers of
yeah.
meaning to our reading of the text.
That idea of the shaken Etch-a-Sketch,
yeah.
Erasure, you know, mm-hmm. I think one benefit that came from pairing it with Shitty First Drafts is, you know, Anne Lamott talks about in her process after she's, you know, vomited out that draft that's twice as long as it should be, she gets out her pen and then deletes everything she can.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that idea of the erasure leaves the child buried at its heart, the good, right. The what's left over is the thing that's good, that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So that connection came up, I think, for us,
mm-hmm.
Having just read Anne Lamott.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you pair it differently, how it's that's going to influence the
totally.
Reading, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to go maybe big picture for just a second,
mm-hmm.
like that is to me one of the one of the most reliable ways to do analysis of a work,
mm-hmm.
right? Is to pair it with another text
mm-hmm.
and kind of see what connections can be formed or just like what we make of the two
mm-hmm.
put together, like just that kind of yeah. everyday language, you know. Let's read this. Let's read this. And like, what do we make of this pairing,
mm-hmm.
right? Just and so I love that that we are pairing that with these other two mm-hmm. texts, and it's not necessarily what other text that we pair it with. Y'all selected yeah. different ones, but it's that we are, mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. I think I just appreciate. One of the things that's like I think is I wanted to ask is this: like, y'all are not teaching a poetry course, right? And yet, we can bring in profitably, mm-hmm. you know, poems.
Yes.
Right? How do you position, to the extent that you do, a guiding question for the work? And I can kind of rephrase that. But I think, Monica, you said something like, what's it talking about? Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that you had your kind of students discuss.
Well, and to maybe erase what I said before,
sure.
I always try to, especially because this was week one for us, so mm-hmm. I really started with what speaks to you. That's actually the question.
Okay. Yeah.
What
okay.
speaks to you in this poem? So that it's just more like, whether it is because you don't understand or mm-hmm. you just like how those words sound or yeah. that image strikes you in some way. So, mm-hmm. yeah, what speaks?
Yeah, similarly, I find the conversation in my classroom always begins with, what do you notice?
Mm.
And it could be anything. Just what do you notice?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, the reason why I want to raise that question, what speaks to you, what do you notice, is the students, because they're not English majors, right, the mm-hmm. students oftentimes need a nudge to set their reader's purpose mm-hmm. for something where the purpose of the text is not included in its title,
mm-hmm.
yeah. right? Like it would be in something expository,
mm-hmm.
you know, oftentimes.
Right.
But yet the danger, of course, in helping the students with their reader's purpose is if we kind of give them like an artificial one,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it would be like, I just love to hear what speaks to you? What do you notice? Because here's the test I always think of as a reader's purpose. Would this question make sense outside of school?
Mm-hmm.
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 What speaks to you? Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you notice? Absolutely. In a group of writers who get together, mm-hmm. right, they ask these same exact questions. And I just think that it
yeah.
really speaks to you two and how much you embody the writer reader craft as teacher, that you're able to come up with those organic and natural questions that pass muster, real world mm-hmm. muster. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the main idea?
Could
you imagine read this poem and tell me what the main idea is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, we got to work up to that, right?
Like, yeah.
We get there. But it's not the opening question.
Start there.
By the time we get there, we may not even be using the term main idea, you know?
No,
yeah.
No. That's like where, when students are maybe sharing their, you know, the lines mm-hmm. they like, then I might say something like, what do you think, what does that mean? What did that mean when you read that for you? What did, you know, how did you interpret yeah. that? And
yes.
then we go from there. We let, like, we meander.
So, as we start wrapping up, where do you kind of want to like leave things? What are some maybe final mm-hmm. thoughts? What's on your mind as you sort of head into the next work with your students?
If you had asked me, 5 or 6 weeks ago, I would have been like really confident about everything I'm doing this semester. I've learned from last semester from my mistakes, and I've got it. And I think. The fun of this experiment is that as we do it, it becomes, I realize as I go how still labyrinthine it is.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I want to talk about going forward is the dead ends, the labyrinth that we're still working our way through.
Yeah. I like that. There's just still a tweaking, a revision process that's happening, mm-hmm. building off of what we discovered works last time, mm-hmm. but just to continue building from there, to not just say, oh, okay, we figured it out, so now we're just going to do this over and over and over again, but allowing ourselves to keep experimenting, to keep evolving, to keep exploring the labyrinth, as you said. Yeah.
And if we can add a PS, that maybe we'll make the cut, or maybe we can delete it.
Sure.
It doesn't. When I was looking at this, the poem, one of the things that I just kind of made a note to myself when I came across the line, dead ends that seem like lucky breaks, mm-hmm. is just was a reminder to me, whether or not that was the intention of the speaker, it was just reverence for everything. Just this word reverence.
Mm-hmm.
This really touched me. And I'll share just a kind of one thing that is kind of giving me a sense, that is sort of activating reverence for me right now. In a world that is so dominated by screens, mm-hmm. that I still walk into a classroom face to face, and there are students that do show up. Right. And we in person, mm-hmm. roll up our sleeves and we work with language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what keeps us coming back to these walls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Ari, thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah. Of course. Thanks for inviting.
We love having you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for this. And, Thank you, listener. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the English 101 Experiment. All music heard during this episode comes from the Free Music Archive. Specific titles and artists are listed on the English 101 Experiment website.